the goal of anthropology is to take other cultures seriously, to spend a long time listening to them. You know, one of the cliches, you know yourself through the other. Through living in a different world, you come to see what are the irreducible parts of yourself. And to use that as a basis to increase our ability to understand each other across our differences. That's what the future of the world is about. You know, how can we understand each other across difference?
Hi, everyone. Today, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Janet Hoskins, a professor of anthropology and religion at the University of Southern California. Her current research interests are the emergent field of trans-Pacific studies, post-colonial studies, transnational religions, visual anthropology and ethnography, material culture, theories of time and history, gender, exchange, and ritual. Today, we discuss her long career in anthropology, her field work in Indonesia, Vietnam, and California, her thoughts on anthropological pessimism and optimism, globalization versus hybridization, the role of photography in visual anthropology, the anthropology of tourism, and ultimately what we who are not anthropologists can learn from her practice and study. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Professor Hoskins.
Hi, Robert. Oh,
thank you so much. I can call you Professor Hoskins or Janet. What do you?
You can call me Jeff.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. I know your time is very valuable. I've read your two books.
Oh, wonderful.
The Cow Dao one I have not finished. That one is a dense academic book. I thought I watched some of your videos and scholarship online. And again, I really appreciate your time. Thought we'd frame our conversation. Maybe you had this interesting dialectic between what you call anthropological pessimism and anthropological optimism.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought maybe that'd be a good point to, you know, give us a little bit of framework for what brought you into anthropology, your fieldwork in Sumba, and then maybe that evolution of seeing the traditional anthropology and how that has evolved.
Sure. And it comes obviously from a talk I gave, so it is familiar to me. Basically, the ideas of anthropological optimism and anthropological pessimism were ideas I decided to draw on for a talk I gave when I went back to my undergraduate college, Pomona, and talked about basically the pathways I had followed since graduating from college and why I became an anthropologist. And anthropological pessimism is an attitude that the discipline had for a really long time, which was that we were doing what they call salvage anthropology. We were saving relics or artifacts from a disappearing world. And that, unfortunately, was quite true of a lot of anthropology that was done, particularly in North America, among Native Americans who'd been devastated by epidemics, who'd been hunted, sometimes even enslaved. There was a pretty grim story of culture loss that was pretty common in many areas of North America. That's no longer as true. In California, for instance, the number of actual California Indians, it has come up to pre-contact levels. It wasn't a huge population before contact, but they were almost wiped out. And now they've come back to pre-contact levels. So there are reasons for seeing at least a biological resurgence. And of course, their lives are completely transformed. Now they share this state with, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people of different ethnicities. It's no longer, the environment has been almost completely transformed. But there has been some resurgence of indigenous ways of life. And that resurgence is what I identify as a kind of anthropological optimism. There are ways in which we could see worlds changing, worlds transforming, worlds rebuilding themselves. And that is encouraging. And we can see this, for me, in both of the places where I did sustained research, one on this relatively remote island in Indonesia, Sumba, where I did my first book and a couple of other books dealing with that area, And then later in Vietnam, the reasons for devastation, or the reasons for troubled periods, are somewhat different. Both areas were colonized. A place like Sumba never had, it was part of the Netherlands East Indies, but it was never, there were never very many Dutch people there. They were, however, administratively taken over. Many changes happened also after independence in 1950. There were forced transitions for many local customs. Now, however, the indigenous religion of Sumba, which is called Marapu, and it means something like the invisible ones, the ones we don't see. It includes ancestors, but not only ancestors. It can also be spirits of particularly sacred aspects of the landscape. It can be spirits associated with animals that have a kind of totemic presence, like crocodiles are important, snakes, birds, particularly wild animals. And now Marapu is Indonesia's largest indigenous religion in terms of the number of adherents. There is a new Facebook presence, Save Our Indigenous Religion, a website called Marapu. There's a reggae group that sings songs about Marapu beliefs. There's been a very encouraging cultural resurgence. It's true that since the turn of the 21st century, technically a slight majority of people on Sumba now follow Christianity. When I first went there, it was what they used to say is 80% Marapu. And so that shift has happened. They're in a majority Muslim nation, but they have found ways to, I would say the Christian Sumbanese are also very committed to honoring their ancestors and are very interested in Marapu traditions. Right now there's a wonderful Australian ethnomusicologist who has a program that they call Marapu Arts. So they teach songs and rituals and dances in primary schools. And those are kept alive partly through the somewhat more formal program of teaching so that they wouldn't disappear. So,
sidestep for 1 second. Could you tell people where you work, just for people who aren't familiar, and what department you're part of? I think religious studies and anthropology.
I'm a professor at the University of Southern California. I see myself as an anthropologist. At this point, I'm also affiliated with the religion department, but that affiliation is also somewhat more recent because the indigenous religions that I studied on Kodi are not usually considered by religion departments as something that is studied under that discipline. They study religions of the book, religions that have scriptures, religions that have a formal organizational structure. I think that's unfortunate, but that's pretty much the way it is. I started doing work on this Indonesian island called Sumba. I tell people it's three islands east of Bali and you turn right. And it's a decent size island. It's about the size of Connecticut or Jamaica, not a tiny little dot in the ocean. It has something like 600,000 people, about 100,000 of them speak the Kodi language, which was the language that I learned. It was, up until the end of the 20th century, the last island in the Malay archipelago to still have a pagan majority. Now, as I've indicated, there's a slight majority of Christians. There's also a small percentage of Muslims. It's a majority Muslim country.
Why did you choose Sumba? Maybe expand on the kind of romantic ideals of anthropology at that time. Your own desire to, I guess, extinguish some of your cultural, get into the cultural shock of a different place, and maybe expand on that a bit.
I became an anthropologist because I was very interested in travel, but I wanted travel to be more than just tourism or stopping briefly, taking a whole bunch of photographs and sort of carrying them back. Oh, look, I've been there, you know. And anthropology appealed to me because you stay for a much longer period of time, you learn the local language, you try to understand people. You also, field work takes you out of your comfort bubble to an extreme extent. You know, you're living someplace very, very different from where you grew up. I grew up in Southern California. And so, you know, going to a remote island where no one had electricity, no one had internet, which didn't even exist at that time, basically no one had running water. And yet people had lived there. They had a vibrant ceremonial life. They were proud of the traditions of their ancestors. After they got used to it, they were sort of happy to have someone coming from the United States and trying to learn about their culture. for me, the appeal was the kind of challenge that that presents to your understanding of the world. You have to reinvent yourself anew in a new context.
What is that process of cultural disorientation as a Westerner coming into? What are the benefits of that? What are you, is there almost like a religious aspect to it, like breaking down identity?
The process is very much like being raised again. I was 25 when I first went there, but in some ways it's a bit like being 4 or 5 again, because although I had prepared for fieldwork, I'd read what you could read about the island. I had studied Indonesian, which is the national language, which is the line about Indonesian is it's a relatively easy language to speak badly. It's a fairly grammatically simplified language that was used as a trade language across the archipelago. I knew Indonesian. I was able to talk to almost anyone under 40 who had gone to elementary school. And because Sumba already has 10 different local languages, people would use Indonesian in towns and to talk to other people with different local languages. Learning the language, because there weren't textbooks, because it was only an oral language, involved basically just following people around, imitating them, and I was often taught by children. Children love, they're really enthusiastic language teachers for adults. They love to correct you. They love to tell you you've got it wrong. They love to repeat it again for you so that you'll get it right. And so in a sense, you learn the language. And for most people there, I think the most important thing was that I learned the language. They said, it's weird. There's this foreign woman. She came and she learned our language.
Yeah.
But it's also learning a culture, learning a whole system of values, learning all the things that are part of language learning, which is what isn't said as well as what is said. There's something humbling and also deeply satisfying about going back and trying to learn a language at that level. Then I also spent, a lot of time taping songs, taping myths, taping rituals, creating records of things were to some extent endangered, although it wasn't quite like the situation of California Indians, where certainly the population wasn't dying out. Their population has increased a bit. Modestly, fortunately, their family planning efforts have been relatively successful. So people are now having smaller families, not the really large ones they had when they also had really huge infant mortality and they only expected half the kids to survive. It's a process of discovery also of a whole lot of differences on a more abstract level. So the first book is called The Play of Time, and it's actually about notions of time and calendars. The calendar they use is a lunar calendar. It's built around an annual swarming of the sea worms that happens in February, which of course is roughly the time of the what we call the Chinese New Year or the Lunar New Year. I speculate, I don't even put this in this book because it's pure speculation, but there's a biological marker in the swarming of these sea worms. And it is used to anchor the Kodi calendar. That's how they know, how they adjust it from a lunar calendar to a solar calendar, which will be true to the rhythm of the seasons. It's very possible that even China and Japan and Vietnam and all these other countries that use a lunar calendar at one time had a biological marker that caused them to begin the new year in what we consider February. And so that, I think, is interesting. What I was looking at in the book was how the head priest of the sea worms was facing challenges, because when their new year begins, they have a splendid festival. They have a mounted combat, which is kind of like jousting on horseback. There are several hundred people on horseback from one side of the valley who ride against the others. From the other side of the valley, they throw lances at each other and try to knock people off. They call it training for warfare, because earlier before the beginning of the 20th century, they were actually at war with each other fairly often and throwing real spears. Because this is now a tourist attraction, it now has thousands of spectators who will come to see it. There was a lot of pressure on the sea worm priest to adjust himself to printed calendars. And the book is partly about his struggle to keep indigenous forms of knowledge going against pressures of tourism. The pressures of tourism are still there. They've recently opened a bunch of luxury resorts, relatively small luxury resorts on the island. One of them is this, it's called now Nihisumba. It's a hotel that won the award for the best hotel in the world years running. And it offers, you know, luxury at the edge of wildness, experiences where people can ride horses into the surf and swim with horses. And it also offers superb surfing on this particular place on the southern coast of the island. The district where I worked also offers reasonably good surfing, not quite as good as that particular location, but also now is the site of a new luxury resort with French and Russian funding that has just opened this past summer. So tourism is affecting this island, but it's also helping them to preserve some of their local traditions, because tourists are coming to see a place that still has traditional architecture, to see the beautiful Sumbanese homes, which have a very high tower, sort of like a thatched skyscraper, and you have the sacred objects up at the very top. And
what can lay people learn from your anthropological work? Because you said you wanted to travel in a deeper way. And I think you had some quote that anthropology is deep hanging out or deep. How can people, like, what's the point of anthropology for lay people? I understand there's all this folkloric, this image of Indiana Jones going and, quote, noting or robbing cultural artifacts. And maybe we can talk about the popular image and then what the reality is and what normal people can take away from your practices.
Sure. Well, Indiana Jones was an archaeologist, so he's trying to bring back trophy objects. I've actually done some archaeology myself, and there's very little bringing back trophy objects. Mainly, you spend hours digging and drawing, making drawings of every little spot that you've dug and noting where there was a tiny shard of a pot or a little piece of something that could be analyzed, usually not a gold treasure, usually nothing particularly valuable. But I do cultural anthropology, which is not so much digging up treasures, but living with people and trying to learn from them, trying to learn with them, because all of cultural anthropology requires that they collaborate. You know, there's nothing, if people don't want to talk to you, they don't have to. So you have to, the deep hanging out is a phrase from Renato Rosaldo, who argued that basically that's what fieldwork is. It's not just hanging out, but hanging out with questions, hanging out sort of on a philosophical quest, hanging out trying to figure out what is the reason why these people live the way that they do. So I think for the general public, I hope anthropology books would be interesting because they're much more than a travel guide. You know, the travel guide will tell you where you can get good meals, where you can arrange transportation, so forth. The ethnography tries to take you deeper into people's lives and get you to understand what's important to them and how that works. And so there are different ways of telling that story. In The Play of Time, I was more interested in a somewhat abstract argument about calendars and about notions of time. I have another book called Biographical Objects, which is about how people tell their own stories through objects. So basically how their possessions can help us to understand how their lives work. That's more like almost a series of short stories. There's one person and one object in each chapter. You see how people become attached to objects, how they can tell their own biographies through the medium of an object, how the object can become important to them because it shares a whole series of life experiences with them. And so that's probably the most accessible work. It's the work I actually have undergraduates read, because it has more about people's personal lives, about romance, about loss, about domestic conflicts, about polygamy, which is, or was at least practiced in Sumba, still exists to some extent. I knew one man who's still alive who had 12 wives, and sort of he was kind of the polygamy poster boy for that particular part of the island. But so there are more stories about sort of domestic life and people's attachments that are worked through an attachment through an object that they've had for a long time, that's aged with them, that becomes linked to their biography. So that's the idea of a biographical object. Yeah.
Could you walk me through? I thought the calendar thing is very interesting because it's a good way for people to understand how temporal markers are even something most Westerners think, you know, everyone uses the Gregorian calendar. But if you go to Japan, all the dates are an imperial calendar system in addition to the Western Gregorian. How can people take away from the radical differences in timekeeping as a way to analyze reality as a framework?
Well, on Sumba, the lunar calendar is basically managed by a priest who has to adjust the lunar calendar to the fact that seasons work on a solar calendar. The mechanisms we have in our calendar of having leap year, we just had one a little while ago. Every 4 years, we have one extra day. Basically, there's a priest who deals with those kinds of adjustments. And he does it really through his knowledge of the natural world, through looking at flowers blooming, through looking at when the rains come. But it's enormously important that he get it right because this is an agricultural people. So when we're living in a city, if the rains come a little early or the rains come a little late, and we've had a lot of that with climate change, it's, you know, we get wet or something. It's not a big deal. If you're planting crops, it makes an enormous difference. If you plant too early, the rains don't come, the crops die. If the rains are much heavier than expected, the crops will also die. So you really depend for your livelihood on this priest who is sensitive to natural changes, will determine, the way they put it, he determines the start of the Pasola festival, but that actually determines also the planting that you're going to have in October, the harvest, which is going to come probably in April. All of those things have to be coordinated by someone who has a very detailed knowledge of the natural environment. The lunar calendar, all early calendars were lunar calendars. It's the marker that almost every culture has used. We even, you know, things we call months come obviously from the word for moon, although now we've separated them from that because of our use of the Gregorian calendar. There are many ways in which a lot of rituals are partly about coordinating time, getting people to work together on time, using the resources of time in an agricultural society to increase productivity, to make their livelihoods more predictable, ordered. And there's a lot of communal labor. No one on this island had a tractor. No one had the kind of agribusiness technology that we have in this country. So the way you did when it was time to plant, you took out your buffalo and they would trample the fields, and that would make the fields softer because there was no plow. When it was time to harvest, you invited 30 people, you killed a couple of pigs, and they would help you do the harvest together. And you would have songs all night long to entertain them. In a sense, people were paid with food. They were paid with entertainment. They weren't paid with cash. Yeah. So it requires a whole lot of social coordination that was invested in particular ritual leaders. And that is something we could learn from, I think.
How do you, in anthropology, could you maybe walk me through cultural relativism? If you read travel writers like Paul Thoreau, there's often an element of judgment or comparison. There's more of a criticism of differences, right? Or sometimes going native and wanting those differences. What's the role of anthropology in terms of?
Well, cultural relativism now is a perhaps a dated concept. It was introduced in the 1930s and 40s. And basically, it was usually an idea of suspending judgment. Someone like Margaret Mead would talk about that. And she would go to another culture like Samoa, and she would say, we should have an open mind about the practices that they have. We should not immediately judge them. And to understand them, we have to first come to see that why they are valuable to the people who have these practices. And that's enormously important. That obviously, we still stand behind that element of cultural relativism. More recently, there are people who've said that cultural relativism can also block us from condemning some of the excesses of indigenous genocide up for Native Americans, for instance, which has been pretty extensive, or some of the excesses of colonialism, which also had been pretty extensive in many parts of the world. I don't think that cultural relativism paralyzes us from having our own moral judgments and our own sense of moral responsibility, but it does tell us to wait, not to judge immediately, first to try to understand. And I think that is what is still valuable about that attitude.
Well, the reason I bring it up is that, well, we can talk about it later in your Cao Dao work, but you use the word beliefs in some of your description of the Cao Dao practices. And I was wondering if that's a loaded, like the role of cultural relativism in, there's another anthropologist I was reading. His name is Marshall Shallon.
Marshall Shallon. Yeah.
So, yes. And his role is that, you know, using terms and anthropological frameworks almost have that cultural relativism disbelieves their practices. There's a, and he says that, you know, you almost have to really believe what they're believing because, you know, across time and space. And so maybe the question I have is how far, when you went to Sumba and you're, you know, engaging in, you know, going back to 4 and 5, my daughter, who's, you know, just turned 6, she believes everything we tell her. Are you believing everything the elders and parents, how do you, what's the role of belief and not belief and playing with the culture and forgetting your own culture? What does that play into things?
Well, I think our first duty is to listen. And obviously, when going back to the example of learning a language, that's what you first have to do. First, you listen, usually you imitate, and then you try to figure out what they're teaching you and what are they really saying. I think the role of the anthropologist is always to listen and to try to see things. The old phrase, which Clifford Geertz used to use, was from the native's point of view. How do they understand a situation? How do they understand a problem? We may not share their particular beliefs. You know, I had lots of discussions with people in Sumba about polygamy. And I said, you know, to Americans, this seems horribly oppressive of women. We don't think it's fair. And they would say, but Americans, you have divorce. You just throw these women away. You know, men just throw their wives away after they're tired of them. I said, well, the women then get to remarry. You know, it doesn't. So I'd have a lot of kind of humorous discussions about cultural difference, let's put it that way. But I didn't feel that it was my role to be imposing my own cultural ideas onto another culture. So if I write about polygamy, I write about how they practice it, why it is often frustrating for men and for women, you know, and why it doesn't seem to work as a particularly good system for them. Nevertheless, it is their system. And it's not my role really to tell them to change their system. I believe that is still appropriate. Cao Dais formally set up scriptures and structures of beliefs, and they set up a new religious system, a new religious field, even in the term, the technical term that we tend to use in Vietnam when they created a new religion. On Sumba, these were more like most of what Marshall Solins talks about. This was an indigenous religion that saw itself as rooted in the land. They have myths about people coming there, ancestors coming there a very long time ago. They have myths that at one point, people and animals used to talk to each other. They had a shared language. Later, after domestication, the animals, particularly the buffalo, who are big, big imposing animals, they surrendered for protection against wild animals, for regular food. They surrendered and became domesticated, and then you could lead them around by the little nose ring. This huge 1,000-pound animal could be led by a nose ring into a ceremonial field and slaughtered because it had surrendered its power of speech because it became domesticated. So on Sumba, this was a true indigenous tradition that was linked to, they believe, the first time that human beings came onto their island. And so that they would state these things as simply the truth about the background of their island, their land. And the word for world is island for these people. The island is practically the world. Cao Dais already came into being in French colonial Vietnam. They were aware of all kinds of differences between world religions. They wanted Vietnam to have its own place as the home of a new world religion. So they had a very different attitude. And they were entering the world of comparative religion and presenting their new model. Whereas the indigenous belief system was more, this is the order of the world as we've come to see it in this place since time immemorial. And that is how we see this particular system taking shape.
Before we talk about Cao Dai, could you walk me through how How do you approach ethnographic visual anthropology? How do you document things? What's the role of voyeurism in anthropology, and how do you play with that lens? What's the best role of an anthropologist or someone lay can take from documenting other places or people?
Well, I mean, actually, on the topic of voyeurism, I wrote a paper called Predatory Voyeurs, which is about Somali's beliefs about early tourists. And Sumba was an island that had been raided for slavery. We're very familiar with the cross-Atlantic slavery, but there was also a slave trade across the Indian Ocean. And Sumba was an island that was raided, and its people were sold off to Madagascar, where most people do speak an Indonesian language, interestingly enough.
And this is the Dutch who are doing this, or this is Indonesian?
It was even before the Dutch. The Dutch claimed that they were helping to wipe out the slave trade. Actually, they participated in it a bit as well. It was an early trade. It was run often by Arabs. And it was very much in place in the early 1800s. Then when the Dutch achieved pacification, they sort of wanted credit for ending the slave trade, although they had themselves participated in it a few centuries earlier, like the British, like many others. Yeah. So, but with this history of having raids where people were captured and sold off on other islands, there was fear of foreigners on Sumba, and particularly fear of what we would call the hippie travelers, people with long hair, flowing clothing, Birkenstocks. And there was an idea that they could be what they call penyamun, which is basically kidnappers. Yeah. And also that they might themselves take heads. Although the Sumbanese did take heads among each other as part of indigenous warfare. And so there was also a fear of cameras, that the camera could be used as an instrument to drain children of their vitality. Foreign visitors, tourists would often, as in many parts of Indonesia, they'd just get followed by heaps of kids who were, hey, mister, you know, take my picture. And there was fear that there might be danger to them. So this was an early fearful attitude towards tourism that emerged when tourists were very rare on the island. I don't think it prevails anymore, but certainly at that time, there was a view that the camera itself was a kind of vampire-like instrument, that it could suck out some sort of vital energy from especially children and damage them. So when I came there and stayed there for a long time, I could take pictures. It was pre-digital age. To even develop the film, it had to be sent off to another island. It took months to get it back, you know, whatever. It was very complicated, but photographs were valuable souvenirs because very few people had their own cameras. Yeah. All of that has changed now. Now they have little, what they call hand phones, which we would call cell phones, are extremely common. They're used. People who never could have had a landline do their business through hand phones all the time. So huge technology changes. But one thing I did do in connection with all of my research trips, both to Indonesia and to Vietnam, is I worked with my sister and another ethnographic filmmaker to make a series of movies. Yeah. And so the films that we shot were shot with local collaboration. They were an effort. There's one film particularly focused on the Pasola. There's one focused on a ceremony for, it's called Dream Village, a village that burned down. And then they have to bring back the soul of the village so that fertility can return. And I also worked on a film about the Kaudai religion. So for all of those, it was very important to have Native collaborators and to share the results with them. So where possible, this was difficult back in those days, we brought a little battery-powered, not really a projector, but a little
monitor of some kind to watch.
A little monitor that could sit on the top, on the back of a motorbike, because we had no vehicles. Yeah. So, and we would bring that in and we screened the films for the people who were in them. We interviewed them about their response to it. We got their feedback on editing that we had done, things like that. So it is true that most tourists, the main thing they take when they go to a remote area is photographs. The main thing they have is the proof that they've been there. They will buy some handicrafts on Sumba. Traditionally, people buy the beautiful textiles, which are quite famous. And they'll sometimes buy carvings and other things. But mainly, the form of consumption for remote tourism is mainly the souvenir photograph. And that does create a lot of complex issues around photographing. Now, the most famous tourist Sumbanese villages have what they call a guest book. They'll often charge a small amount of money for people to come in and take photographs. These seem to me, at this point, reasonable ways of, to some extent, controlling, monitoring, presenting some sort of local revenue for these people who come in and take photographs.
Maybe you can walk me through how did tourism comes in and then people start coming up with new forms of dress or costume or, you know, revitalizing certain traditions or folklores. I mean, there's other anthropologists who've written about that. Sometimes people will strengthen traditions and almost play or a costume for the tourists or for that economic drive, or the positives of it, it revitalizes some of the traditions.
It can certainly provide money and support for keeping up particularly traditional architecture, which is something I think Sumbanese wanted to keep up, but at this point they can get small government subsidies for rebuilding some of the beautiful old clan houses and for some particular ceremonies. And I think that is valuable. I think that's not culture loss. There was early writing about tourism. There was a whole lot about what is authentic or inauthentic. I think that's not a very useful distinction, because people do reinvent their cultures. They do change. They do bring in new elements. And if they come, you know, from the people who are doing them, if they're not actually scripted by the tourist guide or something, then I find they're quite valuable. We should be open to them. On Sumba, because there is now this movement for supporting the Marapu arts, under the label of art, even people who technically have become Christian, very much involved in performing what were once ancestral ceremonies. And there was a long negotiation with missionaries. At one point, missionaries said, you shouldn't do any sacrifices. You should be buried in Christian cemeteries. All the Dutch missionaries are gone now. There were German Catholics, and they're gone as well. It's now all indigenous people who are both the Catholic priests and the Protestant ministers, and they're much more open to keeping the ancestral ways going. And so you have the traditional burials right in the center of the village in a megalithic grave. Sumba's famous for still having a sort of living megalithic culture. It produces graves a lot like what you see in England at Stonehenge and in various parts of Scandinavia, but they're still doing it. Yeah. And now they'll put a little cross on top of the grave. And aside from that, it will be basically very ancestral, very much on an ancestral pattern. So there have been ways that they've been able to revitalize their culture, partly because of the hope of increased tourism. Now, all that hope was kind of stalled, obviously, during the COVID years. They started building all these resorts, and then they had only domestic tourists for 2 years. There's an effort to make Sumba the new Bali, which I'm kind of afraid of, because Bali is, of course, famous for its elaborate cultural performances, but also it's just been ecologically devastated. You know, the environmental impact of tourism on Bali has been awful. There have been plastic bags everywhere and all kinds of concrete rolled all over rice fields and so forth. I have a feeling Sumba will never... I hope it will never support the same number of tourists that travel to Bali. But tourism can also be helpful to them in certain ways, and certainly in getting respect for the largest indigenous religion left in Indonesia. I think it is important.
Did anyone from the Sumba want to visit the West, for instance, when after you met them, did they want to come to California and see, quote, your culture and your way of living? Or did they just... Did you bring any to California? I mean, I'm just curious how that interaction works.
I didn't actually bring anyone, but a bunch of Sumanese have come to California, well, or to the United States. I documented the history of one family. It was a particularly interesting history because the grandfather had been a headhunter and had been sold as a slave. And then later his head was taken, his son negotiated to get the father's head back from the village that took it. and married a bride from that village in order to get the head back. And so, and this man later became the Raja, the Dutch appointed ruler of a district called Rara. And that family, he sent his son to school in the Philippines, married a Filipino woman, settled in Jakarta. He now has two children who've lived in the United States. I had a young girl who came. I'd met her father when he was on Suba, and she came by on a school trip and she wanted to go to Disneyland. So we went to Disneyland. I've had a couple of other Sumbanese who visited for various reasons, often related to government projects. So yes, they are traveling now. Certainly not large numbers of them, but there've been Sumbanese who've come and done master's degrees in programs in Southeast Asian studies. The head of there's a committee for Southeast Asian studies, which is an international committee, and one of the leaders in it is a man named Joseph Jacobaba, who is whose father comes from Sumba. And so, yes, there are educated Sumbanese, there are people who've traveled to other places, not as many as from many other islands, but certainly that is also part of their world now. Yeah.
Does that lead to a hybridization, or how do they, because you were saying they put the cross with the pagan symbolism, and what do you think of hybridization? Is that part of globalization, or is it different, or is it multipolar, or how is that?
Well, in a sense, everything is hybrid. Everything develops through a process. Syncretism is the generator for all religions. You combine, you recombine, you have a new vision. And syncretism, although there's an idea of lost authenticity, there never is that moment of full authenticity. Everything has always, with unwritten traditions like Sumba, we can only hear what the tradition was, but of course it was combined from something older in the past. If you look at Sumbanese stories, you can see elements that show Hindu and Buddhist influence. You can see there's a demoness off in the forest who they call Kalingaka. And so she's obviously related to the Hindu goddess Kali and to the ancient Hindu and Buddhist kingdoms that you had many centuries ago. You don't see a lot of that, but their word for spirits is Dewa, which is a Sanskritic word. You know, why do you have a Sanskrit word off on a remote island? Well, because they were all part of a larger Hindu-Buddhist empire at some point, you know. So there is no point of absolute authenticity. It's always hybrid. Even the indigenous traditions, even this indigenous religion has elements that come from Hindu-Buddhist past. It has elements that come from other things. It is, they see it as fused with the landscape, but the truth is they will tell you that the first ancestors came riding on horses across these island straits. We know that's not true. We know that in fact Sumba's famous as an island that has as many horses as people, but the horses are about 400 years old, you know. They came with Arab traders about four centuries ago, just as the Plains Indians, who also had a very developed horse culture that's all about our warriors always rode on horses. And in fact, they only came to North America as well through trade, through the Spanish, three or four centuries ago. There is no absolute point of authentic origin, even if there are myths of this, even if people claim that. I did tell this to somebody as they were totally skeptical. They also did not want to believe that tobacco was originally an American crop, which it was, because now tobacco is so much a part of their culture. They said, oh, I can't believe it, you know. And I said, well, sorry, you know, even corn. Yeah, I know corn. Yes, corn. We've been growing corn for centuries. Yeah, well, probably not. Maybe four or five centuries. But, you know, there was a point where corn was introduced into these islands and tobacco and a whole lot of other crops that weren't indigenous many centuries ago. It's all hybrid. Everything in our lives is hybrid. We ourselves are hybrid, combination of the old and the new. Yeah.
So talking of a hybrid, I'm curious, as a parent and now as a grandparent, how do you incorporate some of this anthropological field work, or how do you choose how to parent, or how do you choose? I mean, do you just pick and choose from each culture that you think is the best, or how does that work?
That's an interesting question. Well, I did deliberately drag my daughters, as they put it, I dragged them with me to all kinds of remote Asian locations. And I think that was absolutely fine. And now at this point, I think they agree. You know, I think they appreciate it. But I took them to Sumba. I took them to Vietnam a couple of times. Vietnam was easier to deal with than Sumba because we were, you know, it was an urban setting and there were a variety of things that you could take children to. And on Sumba, you've kind of just got the puppies, the kittens, and the horses, and there's not a lot else to do. In terms of parenting, there's a great love that people throughout Southeast Asia have for their children, and the fathers are extremely involved in childcare. They're carrying those kids from day one. And it's mainly that most of them are working at home and have gardens and they can do that. But that's a big difference from American family patterns, where it used to be that the father was largely gone. You know, he'd come home at five, kiss the kids and tell his wife to put them to bed. So I do admire the closeness that particularly fathers have to children in these societies. Of course, implementing that depends, there are other constraints on that. But so that was something that was inspiring. Children are carried all the time until they reach about the age of 9 months old. And then in Bali and in Sumba, there's a kind of ceremony when you can first let the child touch the ground. And partly that's for somewhat hygienic reasons. I actually believe, as you know, I have a little grandson, we do let him touch the ground. but the idea that just a lot of love and a lot of physical contact and carrying is very important for children is something that I think you see it in Southeast Asian parenting, and you don't see it as much as you should in many American families.
Yeah, I'm, you know, obviously a cosmopolitan person, and I grew up in many cultures as well. So I believe in the aspect of, you know, selective identities you can choose. And I think that's a positive thing. But I always thought anthropology would be a little bit more reactionary in terms of wanting to protect, or maybe that was the pessimistic anthropology where they were trying to. I find you quite optimistic about the hybridization. So I thought most people would be worried about globalization or the force and speed of modernity just erasing cultures and practices.
Well, the point is usually they're transformed rather than just erased. And that's something that I think anthropologists had to learn. There was one point where Margaret Mead, who did a lot of research across Pacific Islands, referred to, you know, the Pacific Islands were this great sort of laboratory of human variation. And so she didn't want that to vanish. Now, unfortunately, a lot of these Pacific Islands, because of global warming, are, among other things, disappearing. I mean, there are really very threatened cultures on a number of Pacific Islands, particularly because of the rising seas. And so that is an urgent salvage message that is important. I think the anthropological pessimism came partly early 20th century. Anthropologists were documenting languages that only had one speaker left who could still speak them. So under those conditions, yes, it is very important to just try to document, just try to preserve, just try to have some record of that cultural heritage that is disappearing very quickly in front of our eyes. But that's not the case in most of the world, fortunately. You know, in most of the world, you have living populations who are transforming themselves, finding new ways of living, finding ways of being culturally distinct and yet part of the modern world. I mean, one thing Marshall Solon says, for instance, a lot of cultures are using new technologies not to turn into copies of the Western world, but to become more like themselves. You know, so Inuit, they're using snowmobiles. Of course, it's a great way to get across all that ice. But at the same time, they're also hunting. You know, they're also preserving a lifestyle, but with modern modifications. And I think that's where we can find optimism. Facing, you know, the devastating level of death that you had indigenous populations in North America, it's understandable that people were sort of pessimistic, that they thought anthropologists were really taking notes on cultural difference that would no longer be with us in a few more years. But in most of the world, that isn't what's happening. What is happening is people are finding new ways of living in the 21st century. There are many things we can learn from these indigenous cultures. And that's the other side of the optimism, is there's a respect for different forms of life, for animal life, for non-human entities that have their own spirits, that have their own souls. There's a way in which Euro-Americans have devastated environments without much regard for those environments. One thing we can learn from a lot of indigenous cultures is to respect the inhabitants of that. One strange thing, Sumba has sacrificial traditions for big for big religious events, they do kill animals. But the animal, they say, they would tell me, we always tell the animal exactly why he dies. No animal just dies for lunch. An animal dies for a particular religious purpose. An animal dies because we have to make contact with the spirit. The animals are not simply sacrificed for profit. They have to, there has to be a religious purpose for almost everything. Even killing a chicken to pray before you go off on a trip, because you look in the chicken's entrails, you try to see whether the signs are good or whether they're bad. All of that shows a respect for other forms of life that hasn't been especially true of Euro American industrial culture, at least for the last century or so. So there's a lot we can learn from them.
Do you think there's a romanticism in that statement, or sometimes how do you play around with that? Sometimes there's a battle between the romantic ideal of the quote indigenous and the non-indigenous. I mean, if the English in England did the same thing and started protesting and trying to renew their cultural practices or whatnot, people might consider them racist or anti-migration. Or how does that, if they don't want the Javanese coming into their island and, you know, Islamifying their culture, that's seen as a positive thing. So I'm curious how anthropology frames those different kind of power dynamics.
Well, Sumba, fortunately, is not an area that is flooded with lots of Javanese transmigrants, partly just because it's a drier island and it's not well suited for the kinds of agriculture they practice on Java. It's true that other islands like Borneo, also called Kalimantan, have been flooded with Javanese transmigrants, and that has places like Papua, they now outnumber the indigenous population. And that has been a serious problem in those areas. Anthropologists are sometimes accused of a kind of romantic escapism. And in some ways, I say, yeah, why did I want to go to Sumba? It was romantic escapism. I did want to see something very different. I did value coming into a conceptual world that would challenge my own. And I think that still is valuable. There's no reason to step back from that. There's also no reason to try to preserve this culture in formaldehyde and not allow it to change, you know, because every culture has to change, has to transform itself. You're recognizing the agency of indigenous peoples when you allow them to redefine what their future is going to be. Sumba is fortunate in the sense of not having a large population of other Indonesians of different ethnic groups, partly because it wasn't economically promising, but also because it was such a backwater, it has maintained a kind of distinctiveness that isn't true of many other islands. And I think it will continue to now, partly because that distinctiveness has become financially valuable as a reason for people to travel to tourists. If you look at the resorts, it's like, come to a world out of time. You'll come step back several centuries. Well, you're not really stepping back several centuries, but you are coming to a very different world. And that in itself has an appeal that they can now use to make their culture stronger, to give themselves a better future.
Talking about different worlds, maybe we can jump to your work on Kaudism. Sorry for mispronouncing it, but it's incredible. And just the hybrid nature of it is very interesting. And the transnational, transcultural, maybe you can walk us through what it is and where you first discovered it.
Well, the irony is I first discovered this very close to where I grew up because I grew up in Claremont. I had been teaching about Southeast Asia for years because I teach big classes about it. So I'd been teaching about Vietnam without ever having gone there. And I had heard about Kaudaism as a sort of millenarian movement that was very important in the 1950s. And there was a famous essay by Bernard Fall, a Franco-American journalist who actually died tragically during the war. And he said, Kaudaism is a dinosaur. He said this in 1954. It's about to lose its political role in the country, and it will probably die out. And I read all this, and then I saw that there was a small temple 10 minutes from where I grew up in Pomona, California, that had just been opened a few years before. A dinosaur. Well, here it is, you know, 40 years after that statement, they're opening a temple in California. They told me, oh, yeah, we're reopening a bunch of temples in Vietnam. We went through this horrible period. We were basically closed down for a quarter century after the communist victory. But now we're expanding in Vietnam. We're expanding in California. And this religion is coming back to life. And I thought, oh, cool. And no one has really written about it in English. for 40 years. I discovered it. One thing that thrilled me about this discovery is we're very used to stories of Westerners going to study with an Indian guru, putting together their own vision of a sort of designer spirituality, taking things from Hinduism, from Buddhism. This was a story of young Vietnamese intellectuals, in a sense, inventing their own religion during the colonial period as a response to the colonial incursions and as a way of making themselves stronger so that they could fight against French colonialism. So that also I found exciting, a very interesting historical development, something that had hardly been written about in English.
Just for a quick summary, how would you describe the religion?
Caudaism is a new religion that emerged in the 1920s during the French colonial period. It's built on the roughly 1,000-year-old syncretism of Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism that you've had in Vietnam for a very long time. Vietnam was under Chinese domination for 1,000 years. Therefore, they practiced Chinese-like Confucianism, the Chinese version of Buddhism and Taoism, and merged this with a lot of Southeast Asian elements. But there was, during the French colonial period, the French saw this as just kind of a jungle of disorganized beliefs. It didn't seem to have any core. There was no key leadership. So there were a series of visions that happened through seances in the 1920s, at a time when seance was also very fashionable in Paris and in upstate New York and various places in the West. And as a result of these visions, they argued that made direct communication with them to form a new religion. They identify a single monotheistic god as the Jade Emperor, who's this figure sort of from Chinese mythology, hadn't really been used as an active monotheistic figure until the early 20th century. Other Chinese groups also did sort of activate this new vision of the Jade Emperor. And so they said the Jade Emperor is the same as Jehovah. He's the father of Jesus and also the person who sent Buddha, Confucius, and Lao Tzu. So it basically brings together the three great Asian traditions, Christianity, also in somewhat minor forms, bits of Judaism and Islam, and says all religions have a common origin. Our religions should be able to live together peacefully. The Vietnamese are going to be the leaders of this effort to unify world religions because they suffered so much. They were the only East Asian culture under full colonial domination because, of course, Japan was never a colony and, in fact, was a colonial power, had its own colonies in Korea and in Taiwan. And so the Vietnamese were the only people of an East Asian culture to be fully under French colonial domination. Therefore, they got this from their suffering. They got this vision of how to bring East and West together. And so this is a new religion made in Vietnam in the 1920s that then was certainly the third largest religion in Vietnam after Buddhism and Catholicism by the 1940s, 1950s. It's once again the third largest religion in Vietnam, although it was pretty much closed down for a period of 1975 to 2000.
Is that because of the communist?
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think one of your talks or in the book, you talk about how it was first used as a, you know, anti-French imperial and then even still anti-communist. So always against the power structures.
Yeah. It was formed because this idea that they had lost the country to the French. They're, of course, still living in the country, but they no longer had control over it. And so it was born as a nationalist religious movement, partly to oppose French colonialism. It was then involved in, they had a 20th century leader who saw himself as sort of the Vietnamese equivalent of Gandhi. He was combining religion and politics. He fought against the partition of Vietnam, just as Gandhi fought against the partition of India. Both of them were unsuccessful. And you had horrible wars and violence, which followed after both of those countries were divided. Then what happened, because Caudais had been associated, they're overwhelmingly in the south and not in the north of Vietnam. They had been associated with the former southern regime. They were basically closed down for about 25 years. Their temples were not destroyed, but they were left sort of to rot. Yeah. And then when Vietnam was trying to open up to the West, renovation, They reestablished diplomatic ties with the U.S. in 1995. They wanted to get into the World Trade Organization. And at that point, they reopened a whole bunch of these Kaodai temples. And they brought back the body of the famous 20th century leader. And they normalized the religion in a lot of ways. They still do not allow the kinds of spirit seances that produce those original visions. Those are still illegal in Vietnam. But they have allowed big ceremonies to take place. There are millions of people who go to the Mid-Autumn Festival for the Mother Goddess. So the religion has been reopened and is now widely practiced. People can list themselves as Kaodaiists. The number of Kaodaiists, it was estimated about 2 million during the colonial period, maybe 3 million in 75, just before it closed down, then virtually vanished for 25 years. Now they say it's about 5 million, which is pretty impressive, you know, for a once repressed tradition that is now emerging. 5 million, when you look at when they're trying to count what are the top 10 religions in the world, aside from the ones that obviously make it, you know, like Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, the ones that might just make it are all about 5 million, you know, Sikhism, Jainism, Kaodaiism. And so it is, when I teach about this, I tell my students, this is the biggest world religion you've never heard of. And it usually is true. Every now and then they've heard of it. In most cases, it's new, its legitimacy has been questioned, it had been deeply suppressed. But now it is.
What I really thought, I saw some of your documentary work on recording the peacock box, I believe it's called, and the
Phoenix.
The Phoenix box and the cult practices and how that almost seems like a Ouija board. What was the culture of that? How do you interact with that? I mean, I don't know what your religious practices are, what your beliefs are. Do you just kind of watch it from behind, or what do you feel when you watch that?
Well, I usually define myself as religiously plural, meaning I think there are lots of religions that have something valid in them, and I don't follow any single tradition. Now, defining myself as religiously plural fits well with Kaodaiists because they also basically define themselves as religiously plural. In terms of the actual practice of the Phoenix basket seances, these are ancient practices in the Chinese world. They go back many, many centuries. They were also discovered by French spiritists. Someone like Alain Kardec adopted these practices in early 20th century France. And there's this movement called Spiritism, which is huge in Brazil, for instance, and in various other countries. Kaodaiism was born from a Spiritism, which was a fusion partly of the way it was practiced in France and also of the way it had been practiced in ancient China. And this is where you use the Phoenix basket. The Phoenix is the firebird. It's the image of renewal, rejuvenation, the bird that burns up and then comes back to life. And so the Phoenix in this seance, you light a little stick of incense. The medium holds a Phoenix basket. He turns. He feels the force of the spirit within him. He starts rapping on the table. And that wraps out various messages that are recorded and become their texts. Now, they see this Phoenix basket as guiding divine revelations. If we're skeptical, one could say could come also from the unconscious of the medium. It could come from, it's not just one person. You'll have a group of at least five people, one person writing down the message, sometimes two people holding the basket. So it's kind of a group enterprise. It does produce a collective message that is consistent with the kinds of messages received by Phoenix baskets in the past. So is it in some way the product of a collective tradition? Yes, I believe so. But I believe that of all religious visions. And its validity is assessed now in relation to, does this sound like the other teachings we've received? It's usually received in verse, so in a rather complex form of 7-8 syllable verse, which is it's something similar to iambic pentameter in English. You know, yes, you and I could generate things in iambic pentameter, but it'd take a little bit of effort. So perhaps we need divine inspiration to do this so effectively. This is where I use cultural relativism. I report on how they assess the validity of the Phoenix basket messages and why these are their scripture. I am not sure that I'm not absolutely convinced that it comes from gods as opposed to from people, let's put it that way. But it does come from an ancient cultural tradition that I have some respect for. And so that's how I would situate myself in relation to that.
Well, that's what that's why I brought up the concept of, what was his name, Marshall Shaolin. He seems to suggest that the anthropologist really needs to believe in what they're believing. That's almost seemed to be my conclusion, not have that cultural relativism. The only way you can really learn what they're thinking is to, you have to believe it as well.
Have to be with them in their thought patterns, which is, I don't challenge the teachings of the Phoenix Basket. You know, I think there's no point in that. I try to listen to them. Yeah. And that process is something where I can learn something about how they look at the world.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said you're a religious pluralist. I'm always curious now that you're part of the Department of Religious Studies as well, if like UFOs are always now kind of a new religion and scientism a new religion. So I'm always interested in, I feel like the West is becoming a little bit more religious now. In a sense, we've lost, and modernity has kind of erased some of individualism, has erased some of traditional Christianity and whatnot. And now people are kind of grasping towards something, you know. So I'm curious what you, as an anthropologist and as a scholar, think about where we're going as in the West. Now, coming back to the West, all this, you've gone to all these places in the world. What can we learn from your work here in the West? Where are we going?
Well, the Victorian anthropologists, late 1800s, believed that by the dawn of the 21st century, religion would be gone. Science would be triumphant, you know. And they predicted this. They were, of course, wrong. You know, religion is tremendously important in international affairs right now. Unfortunately, religious conflicts are motivating all kinds of wars, all kinds of struggles for territory in the Middle East and in many other places. So we certainly are not in a post-religious world. It's true that Euro-Americans are increasingly secular. Many people, I guess like both you and me, don't really have an organized religion that we would tick off on a form, you know. And there are also a lot of other belief systems that have emerged, like these kind of UFO theories and so forth, that I see more as passing fads and not really as full-on religions. But I think religions give a sort of meaning to people. This was one thing about Kaudaism. It emerged in a colonial context when, in a sense, the people had lost their sense of confidence in themselves. They'd been defeated by the French. They didn't want to be Chinese. And what was it to be Vietnamese? And the religion pulled together all kinds of things that allowed them to have a sense of self-respect and to believe in the things that their culture had been doing for the last 100 years or so. And to see those as worthy and as coherent, even. A lot of it was about achieving some sense of coherence. So I think it will still have that role in the future. I would hope that we could move to greater religious tolerance, because particularly the conflicts with Islam are tearing the world apart. Islam will be the largest world religion within about 40 years. The population growth in Islamic countries is larger than the population growth in Christian majority countries. And so Islam will soon be the world's largest religion. It's very important for us to find some way to live in peace with Muslims.
Janet, what is your next work on? Are you closing up the chapter on Cao Dao, or what are you working on now?
Well, I am writing a new paper about Cao Dao now, because I'm going to be going to a conference in Vietnam in August. And that is looking at Cao Dao's relationship to some Chinese, what they call primordial heaven, which is Chinese, early 20th century Chinese sectarian groups that then had an influence on Cao Daoism. And I'm looking actually at what has happened in California with followers of these primordial heaven traditions in contemporary, you know, Little Saigon, San Jose, Los Angeles, Vietnamese who are living in California and are practicing in these traditions. So I'm writing another paper about Cao Daoism. I'm hoping to revisit Indonesia and look at this new resort that is in the same district where I studied and see the impact that has happened. I've done another field study about Vietnamese living in Europe, Little Hanois and Little Saigons. The U.S., we're very familiar particularly in California, with this term Little Saigons, which is where refugees established enclave communities, especially in Southern California, also in the San Jose area. But in Europe, in many countries, Russia, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Germany, you have actually a majority of Vietnamese who came from the north as laborers during an era of socialist labor exchanges in the 1980s, and then many of these people are still there. And so they've formed what are basically little Hanois, government enclave communities that are sympathetic to and still in contact with today's Vietnam, reunited Vietnam under the Hanoi government. So there are huge differences between the cultural customs of the little Hanois and little Saigons, even though it's almost 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War, the American War. And that is interesting, too. You know, why have these persisted? There are significant differences in Buddhism. There are Buddhist temples that fly one flag. There are Buddhist temples that fly another flag. There are Buddhist temples that try to compromise and try to allow people from different groups to mix together. So I have a project about that when I went to Seattle just 2 weeks ago for the Asian Studies meetings, and I was delivering a paper about the Little Hanois and Little Saigons.
Janet, how do you approach all these different communities? What's your tip as the relationship between the interviewee and the interviewer? There's always a theatrical element, but what are tips for people to enter into that exchange?
Partly you come in as curious, you come in as willing to listen. For my project on Little Hanois and Little Saigons, obviously as an American, I realized people have an idea of who you are as an American. Yeah. And I actually, on that project, I collaborate with a Vietnamese anthropologist from Hanoi, Nguyen Thi Hien. And so many people find it paradoxical that we're a team. You know, here's this anthropologist from Hanoi and an anthropologist from LA, and they're doing a collaborative project. And they were, I think, curious just to meet with us because it seemed a strange combination, a strange collaboration. And we were deliberate in trying to set that up that way. Yeah. That was true for the interviews in Europe. I think just humility and curiosity are the main guidelines. Also, just showing a long-term commitment. You know, at this point now, it's been 20 years that I've been looking at cow dyism. It's been 40 years that I've been interested in Sumba. You know, if I keep coming back, people say, well, maybe she's serious. Maybe she does really want to understand. Harder when you're starting to do this work because people are, maybe just like a tourist, may not really have any commitment to it. And of course, I do other things. I bring copies of my books when I go back. I give copies of the books to people. We've shared videos. I've shared photographs. By continuing to show that you value people as interlocutors, that they're part of a long conversation, that's how you convince people that you're serious and that you really are listening to them.
Fascinating. My last question, Janet, all your travels, what's your relationship with the U.S.? Do you feel more American, more Southern Californian? Are you exporting a California culture? What's your relationship there?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think in many ways, I've worked in places where America has not been a good actor. Certainly Vietnam is one of those, you know. The memories, even of the anti-communist Vietnamese, it's a memory of sort of betrayal, you know, that we supported the government of South Vietnam for a number of years, certainly made the war much longer than it would have been, and then pulled out. Although former refugees are now nationalized and they're American citizens, there's still a kind of memory of betrayal. And ironically, that's less true in Hanoi and in northern Vietnam, where they were the victors, so they have a certain generosity towards this huge nation that they managed to defeat at war. There's a sort of paradox there, but that certainly is true. And now in northern Vietnam, many people want their children to go to college in the United States. They want more connections, and they're building, obviously, a capitalist economy, and they're interested in foreign investment. It's difficult being an American, but you can't ever shed that identity. When you travel overseas, sometimes you realize you're more American than you thought you were. You know, you thought you were this wonderful cosmopolitan person, and yet there are a few things, oh, that's a little weird. You try to get over it, you know. I don't know. Travel is a way of, you know, one of the cliches, you know yourself through the other. Through living in a different world, you come to see what are the irreducible parts of yourself. I've more come to terms with them. Yes, you will apologize for what the American government does in lots of instances. The American government has done lots of bad things. And I try always to present myself as a person not sent by the government, but coming on my own, you know, with my own agendas and not necessarily representing either American business or American governments.
And then, Janet, my last question is, how can people find you? What should they, how, if they want to connect with your work, what's the best way for them to follow it?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously things you've already seen. My website at USC, there are archives of a couple of videos there. There's also a research website, which is just on transnational religion, that has a lot of videos from, we didn't even talk about this, but from another research project about mother goddess religion involves spirit possession. And so there's a lot of stuff out there. If you want an archive of free copies of articles, there's a site called academia.edu. And there are something like 40 articles on that site that anyone can download for free. It's a way to get around the fact that if you're not affiliated with universities, downloading like journal articles, they usually charge you $50. It's something incredible, you know, and they allow us to share our work a few years after it's published, where you don't have to pay for it anymore. So that's academia.edu has a very large number of articles. And then there's a certain number of things on the two websites, which are both accessible just through Janet Hoskins USC. You'll see the link to the professional website, the link to the others, you know.
And then my final question, Janet, is there any other anthropologists or work that you're fascinated with, someone you want to highlight, or your students or any PhD students you're working with, or anything like that that's really interesting to you?
I have a number of very interesting PhD students right now. One is a Filipina student who's made a beautiful film called A is for Augustine about an indigenous man in the Philippines who goes back to elementary school in his 40s because he's illiterate. And he actually graduates. He does 6 years of elementary school and graduates, but unfortunately doesn't necessarily have a prospect for a much better life simply because of the literacy. I have an Indonesian student who's looking at tourism in Indonesia and the impact of the Bali bombings. Tara Parameta is her name, and she's scheduled to finish this spring. I've had several very talented Vietnamese students. One, Tien Hung Ninh, is studying particularly the Catholic figure of the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Lavang, and she's now a tenured professor living in the Sacramento area. I have another student, Viet Le, who teaches at California College of the Arts. He's an artist, particularly a video artist, and he recently became initiated as a sort of indigenous shaman in the mother goddess tradition. So he's performing new ceremonies as both art and as religion, if you want to call it that. So I'm happy to have had a lot of students, many of them from Southeast Asia, many of them not, obviously. Yeah. The president of the American Anthropological Association right now is Carolyn Rouse, who's my former student, who studied African-American Islam. And she now teaches at Princeton.
What would you like people to, who aren't anthropologists, what's your main lesson for them to take away from? Why is anthropology important, or that lens of watching the world important?
Well, anthropology is paying attention for a much longer time to another culture, you know. And again, most of us, you know, I've been a tourist too. Certainly I've traveled to many places like Kyoto, where there's all kinds of fascinating culture, and I didn't have the language resources to fully understand it, you know. But I could appreciate beauty and heritage and all kinds of things that they had there. But I think the goal of anthropology is to take other cultures seriously, to spend a long time listening to them, to write that up in a way that we hope is not too challenging, you know, and to use that as a basis to increase our ability to understand each other across our differences. That's what the future of the world is about. You know, how can we understand each other across difference?
Well, Janet, I really appreciate your time. I know you're very busy, so thank you very much.
Thank you. It was really nice having this long conversation with you.
Datang di tanah suci. Nasumba.